conference when she said she wanted to talk about this, and I got to study and look up and look at commentaries. And there's a poetic version of this, and I don't think it's in the Anguttara Nikaya. I think it's a commentary, but I'm not sure. But I'm going to read it because I thought it was lovely and really explained. You've seen this?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
I don't think so.
All right, so listen carefully. So sensing no change in the changing, sensing pleasure in suffering, sensing self where there's no self, sensing the unlovely as lovely, gone astray with wrong views, beings misperceive with distorted minds, bound in the bondage of Mara, Mara is delusion, those people are far from safety. They're beings that go on flowing, going again from death to birth. But when in the world of darkness, Buddhas arise to make things bright. They present this profound teaching which brings suffering to an end. When those with wisdom have heard this, they recuperate their right minds. They see change in what is changing, suffering where there is suffering, non-self in what is without self. They see the unlovely as such. By this acceptance of right view, they overcome all suffering. So right view, as Aya mentioned this morning, this is just another description of right view. It's a shortcut to right view, the very first of the pathways. And our delusion comes when we accept whatever we think or whatever our opinions are true. Every one of us does this. We rarely question what is going on. And this teaching is asking us to do this. So you've heard the definition of insanity. I think they say Einstein said it. Making the same mistake over and over again and waiting for different results. That's what we are doing. And I've read this and I often wonder, well, how do we even know they're mistakes? You know, I think that's the problem, not making the same mistake. How do we even know we're making mistakes? We do the same thing over and over because that's what we do. This is what we've learned. This is what we were taught. This is delusional thinking. This is what these vipassana, what again?
Vipalasa.
I'm never going to get this. Vipalasas. So I'm going to come in from a different direction than Aya did, coming in more from right view, and I'm specifically going to start with self. And when I said we often don't know what our mistakes are, it's because, as I mentioned at the beginning, we all have implicit bias. And implicit bias just means we have learned a way to be in the world which is based on genetics, on race, on sex, on age, on culture, you name it. All these things come into being to give us a view that we accept as real. The vipassanas are asking, vipalasas are asking us to question all of this. That's a tall order. But at least when we can start saying, I'm not sure I'm correct in my view, I'm not sure that I'm right, I think that's a huge beginning. A huge beginning. I think in Zen they call it don't know mind or beginner's mind. I think it's the same thing. And unless we can start with questioning our own thoughts, our own attitudes, we're not going to get anywhere. As I said, this is the way the world is, unfortunately, thinking this is the only way to be. If we take it to cultures, United States, this is the only way to be. This culture is the right one. Everyone else is wrong. Capitalism for the world. Well, it worked well here, but will it always work? We have to start questioning what is actually taking place. Right now, this moment, you stop and think, you're forming a view right now of me talking, about the tenor of my voice, about being a female, an older female, all of it. All of it has, you've got an opinion. And that is the filter that you're hearing this through. If you can admit that, that's huge. That's mindfulness. Admitting that is taking place. And what if you could admit it no matter what the situation that you're in? I'm looking at this through a view. That's my filter. Is it true? I've got a big, a lot of you have come to my talks, know I've got a big sign in my refrigerator about your thoughts are not always right. And they're not. They're frequently wrong. In fact, the more I practice, the more wrong I realize I am, which is humbling to just realize, God, all these things I've thought about myself, about everyone else, about the world, really need to be questioned, big time. So is this true? That's a good way of looking at it. Whatever you're saying or thinking or your opinion or judgment of somebody, is this true? You know, if you go to a therapist, and I've never been to a therapist, so I'm kind of speaking out of turn, you will look into, I'm assuming, you know, some of the reasons that cause you to have the view you have, the suffering that you have, let's get to the heart of it kind of thing. But it seems like an awful lot of people who, at least my friends who go into therapy, continue going to therapy, but they don't change their views. It's just ongoing. It's another way of seeing them and why they have them, but they don't change. I think that's what's the radical message in Buddhist practice is the Buddha said, starting right now, this present moment, you can't change anything in the past. And you don't know what the future will bring, but right in this moment, you can see what's happening right now. And what will you do about it? Will you just accept it? Well, I think it's true, or are you going to start questioning? That's a tall order. When I was studying up on this, I read a story. Ajahn Brahm, who's a very famous monk who supports the nuns coming back into existence big time, and a wonderful man and very funny. And he's an abbot in Australia. What's the name of his monastery?
Yanarama.
I'm not saying it, but yeah, that one. And he tells a story. He did an essay on this topic. And the story, apparently, he said it's true, and it happened in Australia 100 years ago. And there was a man who was sentenced to death. I don't know what crime he committed, but he was sentenced to death. And he was given his last meal and said, you will be dying in the morning. And instead of hanging you, we're going to cut your throat. And so he said, okay, and scared, but that's the way it is. And they took him out to cut his throat, but actually they were performing an experiment. They weren't going to cut his throat. They used the blunt end of the razor and sliced his neck. So nothing happened to him. He died. He died within 2 minutes. Why did he die? Because he believed something was going to happen to him. He believed he was going to die, and he did. And this is the mind just taking over, not being with what is really taking place, but with the perception of what he believed was taking place. I mean, it's an awful thing to do. But I guess back in Australia, when you had a lot of people living there and the laws were kind of lawless, they did what they wanted and they did a lot of experiments like that. So we're told to, you know, this prisoner saw things as they really are, and we're told as Buddhist practitioners, see things as they really are. That's hard to do. That's what these teachings are telling us. Can we really see things as they are? I think every one of you has had an aha moment, you know, whether in sitting meditation or I get the more in walking meditation. When you're talking about walking, I think Ajahn Chah said insight comes from walking more frequently than sitting. Sitting is wisdom and walking is insight. So I have found that to be true. You know, just things come up that just kind of randomly, and it explains a lot. It's an aha moment. It's when we're going past our biases, our attachment to view, we're letting go. This is what this practice is all about, is constantly letting go. I'm a huge Tolstoy fan. I think I just read, I've read everything of his, and I just finished his very last novel that he wrote before he died. And the reason I'm a Tolstoy fan, because it's two of the best Dharma books I've ever read were Tolstoy. One is called The Death of Ivan Ilyich. I actually gave it away as Christmas presents a couple of years ago. If you want to read a really good short novel, read The Death of Ivan Ilyich. It is incredible. And the one I just finished reading is, it's a short novel again, it's called Awakening or The Resurrection. It's translated as both. And in this, the principal character is a Russian prince, and he's got everything that life could offer. It actually reminded me of the Buddha. And whatever he wanted, he had. He joined the army and, you know, immediately became a lieutenant or general, somebody important, because he was a prince and had lots of money. And then he went to visit his aunts. And while he was there, there was a beautiful chambermaid, and he, quote, fell in lust with her and raped her and left her pregnant. And he didn't care. He went off to join the army again because it was a peasant. It was a peon, a serb, and serf, rather. And then time passes, 15 years pass. And the story picks up where he has to serve on a jury. And the person that is committed a crime, possibly murder, is this woman. And he's got to sit on this jury. And the reason she has fallen as she has is because of what he did to her 15 years previous. And he wakes up in that moment. He sees the delusion he'd been living, seeing the unlovely as lovely. And he tries to rectify what he had done. He never comes back to the present moment, though. What he does is keep going back. And how can I undo this? And how can I undo that? And the story is, you can't. You can only start right now. What are you going to do with your life right now? You can't change any of that. And so it was a cautionary tale of watch what you're doing to begin with. And then, as we know in Buddhist practice, we practice before, during, and after. And in this case, he should have been practicing after. Now how do I change my life? Not trying to undo everything, because he couldn't. Everybody had changed due to his actions. And so he was disappointed that the woman didn't appreciate that he wanted to save her now. She could have cared less. She was a different person now. She had gone through so much. Anyway, it's an excellent book, and I recommend it highly.
You told us the story end.
I'm not telling. I'm not telling. You have to read the book. It's very good. So the four vipassanas. Vipassana. How am I going to read? Vipa. All right, vipas.
Why don't you just say distortions? Because
okay, yeah, that's you're right.
Or inversions or hallucinations.
All right, hallucinations. I like the hallucinations. I like the perversions as well. I think that's good. So the four of them, I'm starting from a different place. I'm starting with the self because I think. I don't think, I know the Buddha taught the self is the source of all of our suffering. Our egos, our conceit, our obsession with self, and our judging ourselves constantly with others. This is where our suffering comes from. And I think this one encompasses all the rest of the delusions. So I do want to try vipassana. Yeah. getting there. So conceit, in Buddhist practice, I know this is one of my favorite topics. Conceit is mana in Pali. And conceit is the full range of emotion from I am better than anyone else, I know everything, I am it. We might all be thinking of someone who fits that category. And then just the opposite, I'm nothing, I'm worthless. Compared to everyone else, I'm a waste of time. This is whole a continuum of conceit because it's obsession with self and it's suffering. Can you see that? Can you see how that would take place? I know I was in Burma with Joseph Goldstein when he gave me this teaching, and I was blown away because I really was under the delusion. If I thought not well of myself, it was almost like humility or humbleness or, you know, I'm better if I think little of myself. And he cleared that up right away, saying, no, you're obsessed with self. That's suffering. It doesn't matter which end of the spectrum you're on. There are ways of looking at how we're doing in our practice, and one of the very first defilements is having an obsession with self, having everything go through ourselves. I've asked people in my classes, when have you been happiest? When have you been, really happy? And I could ask you, and I think I'd probably get the same answers. Almost consistently, when I'm with a grandchild or a child, when I'm with my dog or a cat, when I'm walking out in nature, when I'm creating an art piece and, you know, I'm just so into it. You notice all of these things, the ego is way in the background, if at all. It's concern with others, it's concern with art, with nature. It's not self. I often tell people who I mentor to really get out of the self, be of service to someone else, do something else that brings you the joy of providing for others. It's the self is gone, and for a little bit you're free. Anyway, so the first of the 10 fetters that I was talking about is about clinging to self, self-image, self-personality. And it's interesting, I just did a two-week silent retreat, and I got into this thing on atoms and quantum physics, which occasionally I do. I don't get any of it, but I find it fascinating that, you know, so much is happening beneath our ability to see. And one of the things I was reading about scientists, mapping of the brain, this is getting back to the self, and they can map areas for all the senses, for memory, actually see exactly where they are, but there's no place where there's a you. There's no one core place you're gonna find you. It's a combination of all these different maps that come together that make you you. And so when we're constantly trying to satisfy the self, it's never going to happen because there's no permanent self to be satisfied. It's an ongoing cause of suffering. So you're a process. If you take it down to the quantum level, you are a bunch of atoms that move around either quickly or not so quickly, and that's about it. We take ourselves so seriously, and we're actually just part of a bunch of other atoms in the world that are going quickly or not quickly. We're part of that. Yet we put ourselves at the pinnacle, and it's all about me, and how am I doing compared to all about you? And suffering for it. And we have really taken this to a bust out with the climate emergency right now to satisfy the sense of self, which can never be satisfied. As the Buddha said, desire can never be satisfied. Desire will never satisfy desire. We keep getting stuff, we keep buying stuff, we keep giving presents to this sense of self. A bigger car, a bigger house, more clothes, better food, wine, you know, whatever it is. Constantly trying to do something so that self is satisfied and happy. That's delusion. It's never going to happen. So let's move on to the other delusions or perversions. And thank you. It's just one of those things I'm never going to get, you know? All right, then I'll do it. I'm going to have to give this talk again and get it right. Huh? All right. I got too many things to remember now to remember this. I liked Vipassanala. Yeah. All right. So seeing no change in the changing. And so why can't, the self doesn't like to see change. If the self sees change, then it's got to question itself. How permanent am I? So we prefer not to see change in the changing. As Aya said this morning, you know, if we take this to the, well, I'll take it to the smaller level. The example that I give all the time that the Buddha mentions over and over again is we don't accept our own deaths. None of us do. How many times have you heard somebody say, if I die? Like there's really a choice. No, I will, yeah, all right. No, it's going to happen, and this is why the Buddha in the five daily recollections said, contemplate death every day. Get used to it. You're not a permanent thing. You're impermanent like everything else. Yet we have this delusion that somehow I'm getting out of it. The rest of you might die, but somehow I'm going to make it. And with many of us, we're doing that now with the environment itself. It's so painful to watch our environment eroding and collapsing. So we prefer not to look at it. I just taught, and some of you were in it, the Buddhist Precepts and Climate Change course. I had to twist some arms to get people to come to it, and people who usually come to my courses said, I'm too depressed. That makes me just sad. I don't want to deal with that. But this is exactly what our practice is. As one of the teachers for this course that I used, David Loy, and we got two people here at least, and there's probably more who are in the course, said, you know, if you had a mother who was dying of cancer, would you just say, can't deal with that, I'm out of here? No, you wouldn't. You would do everything you can. You would be there. And I think all of us have got to be there for our world and for ourselves. Maybe even more importantly, doing what we need to do right now, right at this present moment. Next one is pleasure in suffering. All right, before I go on, can anybody give me an example of, you think this is really pleasurable, but it's really causing suffering?
Bad relationships.
A bad relationship.
Getting drunk.
That's an excellent one. Anybody else have one?
Overeating.
That's a really good one. You know, I'm taking part in the youth sangha, not that I'm youthful or the young person sangha, but I'm the mentor, and Idris here is our chief go-to guy. And we had, at one of our meetings, we were talking about this because we were talking about right view and asked about suffering. And I don't know if it was you or somebody else said the internet. The internet, you go to it, you want to do it, and yet it causes so much suffering because of the comparing mind. Mm-hmm. people are lying on the internet about how well they're doing. So first of all, you're buying into a lie. Then you're comparing your life to that one. And why are they so happy or doing so well and I'm doing so awful? It's all based on delusion. And I think, Idris, you said you cut it out or you're cut way down on
social media.
Good for you. Good for you. So one of the things I suggested that people in the group do is one day a week, no social media, period. Just cut it out. No TV, no phone, no internet. Just don't do it. People want to do solo retreats. If you can't do a day without internet access, it's never going to happen. And then you will see how addicted you are by saying, cut it out for a day. It's really hard. Even I do this once a week, and I probably break the rule at least once or twice. You know, oh God, that text message I was waiting for, I better look. You know, that kind of thing. It's still that anxious, anxiety-provoking kind of feeling. So anyway, you can all think of a lot of examples. Seeing the unlovely as lovely. There's so many, I couldn't even begin to start. I mean, one of my classic ones is people having surgery to stay young. I'll do anything so I won't look my age. God forbid I age. And, you know, seeing this as lovely when it's unlovely to have to cut up your body for delusion. It's insane. And as far as climate change, because we both want to mention climate, because it is the most important issue of our time. Anytime I'm teaching, I want to bring in climate change to it. I asked Aya to do the same thing, and of course I didn't even have to ask because she's such an activist. But regarding climate change, and I wondered about this for a long time, you know, the GDP and growth and everything, and we've got to have 10% growth or, you know, we're below 2% growth. How long can this growth go on? We can't keep growing this economic mechanism. At some point, it's got to stop. But we see it as lovely when we say, oh, the GDP is 5%. This is great. I just think we're just getting quicker to the end. Did you have a question or a comment?
Shocking comment.
Okay.
BBC News, some climate researchers, analysts said that the point of no return for global warming is not 5 years or 10 years or 20 years. It's 18 months.
Yeah. Yeah. This is why we are talking about this, because as we would not leave a dying mother, we will do whatever we can. Whatever we can for ourselves and for whatever is going on. Do you want to say something?
I have a question.
Yeah.
I spend a good deal of my time talking to my fellow classmates who are...
Jim is a real climate activist and spends time lobbying people in Washington. He's on his own dime. He's terrific.
But I'm just like everyone else here. Suffer. I am sad, but I spend a good deal of my time talking to climate change skeptics, because I went to MIT and I was shocked that half of my pledge class were climate change skeptics. And so I'm friends with them. I talk to them. I don't try to convince them. I just tell them what I believe, and then I listen.
That's,
so my question is,
yeah,
is that worth doing? Because I do spend a lot of time doing that.
Jim, I think you're doing the right thing. I mean, I've read a lot about talking to climate change skeptics and what the Buddha had to say about right speech. And research just shows you start arguing with somebody, they become more rigid in their view. Even if they see flaws in their view because of the self, this conceit, they will stick to it just because this is propping up their image of themselves. So I think you're doing exactly what you have to do. You listen, you politely give your reason. That's it. there really isn't much else that can be done.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I wonder though, sometimes of other things that can be done, like, well, maybe it's public, but things can be done, but like how the schools have a lot of throwaway, you know, the trays or styrofoam or plastic, a lot of plastic. I think plastic, and that kind of stuff is used everywhere.
Well, this is what we as people can do, and you're absolutely right. And when we're talking about changing, actually looking at how you're living your life, this is what we can do. Yes, it might be 18 months, but you still live according to the precepts, and you cause as little harm as possible, period. So things like that, and asking, you know, the school, would it be possible for you to consider, you know, using something that isn't going to end up in a landfill for 1,000 years?
Yeah, I'm sure they would if they had an alternative. Mm-hmm. You know, and there are alternatives, but just...
Right. But you start with your own self, and then you reach out, and like Jim and like other activists, you do what you can. That's all we can do. And we have to start doing it and living differently. One of the first things that everybody could do, and you've all heard me say this, and Aya says it all the time, right immediately, is give up eating meat. Immediately. And if you can't give up eating meat, then at least make it just once or twice a week. Because the amount of deforestation to support cattle and feed is what is cutting down the Amazon, which is, you know, palm, well, that's another one. The palm groves in Indonesia, but because people are eating meat at ridiculous levels. Of course, we also have ridiculous levels of colon cancer now as well. Because we.
The same thing with soybeans.
Yes, but it doesn't cause nearly the damage that the addiction to meat has done.
And also the suffering to the animals.
Yes, yeah. No, we have too many people. I mean, it goes down to we're trying to feed way too many people. But it's just said that the one thing you can do if you want to make a difference right now, stop eating meat. If there was nothing else, that would help, or at least cut down on it. And, you know, pleasure and suffering, you know, the example I thought of that is, yeah, I'm having this great steak dinner, but I'm not even thinking of the suffering that happened for me to have this great steak dinner. So you start thinking through, not just through the initial level, but further and further. And how does this affect how you live your life? So I said there was two ways of working with this. I like that you said listening to your good friend. I had read listening to an Arya. Mm. Which it just means an enlightened person.
Into, a wise friend.
Or a wise friend. Yeah, somebody who you know has your best interests at heart, is not going to lie to you. Is, you know, if they're willing to tell you why they think you're suffering, what they see, are you going to take offense or not? Most of us are going to take offense. That's why this Arya, wise person, has got to be someone that you know has got your best interest. You'll pay attention. You still might be hurt, but you know it's not done for any reason other than this person cares about you and they've made an observation and they want you to hear it. It says more about you how you accept that criticism and how firmly entrenched your own ego is. Are you willing to hear? Now again, it's an Arya. Wise person, Kalyanamita, somebody you trust. So that would be the first one. And the second one is, as Aya said, is having a meditation practice. And we say this so often, it's trite. You know, I get tired of hearing it. Meditate. I had an incident just in the past. I after I did my two-week retreat, I went to Michigan for 10 days to visit my son, who is a wildlife biologist and climate change researcher, as is his wife, and met a whole lot of scientists. I had no idea what they were talking about, but I'm glad they talk the way they do. And but the unfortunate thing, while I was there, I didn't get to meditate as much as I do. I normally have a daily practice every morning for 45 minutes. Aya comes over and stays with me. We sit at 6 in the morning for 45 minutes. And I didn't, because the 3-hour time difference, and there was so much going on, and maybe only 3 times did I get to practice. And I noticed, and I didn't even put 2 and 2 together, but as I was coming home, I'm agitated. And by the time I got home, I was really agitated. And I got a text message from my stepdaughter, and it pissed me off. And I just started, what is going on? I didn't feel like me anymore, or whatever me is. And then I stopped and realized I haven't pursued my meditation practice. I was really looking forward today to just sitting, to finally getting it back together. You might not think your meditation practice is working. It's cumulative. It works. You have to keep doing it. Even when you think, I'm bored, this isn't working. I was talking this morning about even boredom, and I read an interesting essay saying boredom is the gateway to enlightenment. And actually seeing boredom for what it is and investigating it, it means you are not clinging to anything. It's just open space. It's a really good way of looking at boredom. So, you know, look at that. Next time you're bored, you're not really clinging to anything. You just want to be doing something else, but right now you're kind of wide open. So you might use that as a springboard. Yes, Maureen?
I've been hearing something similar to that too, but it has to do with like neutral feelings rather than the good and the bad. Raising our tolerance really for being in the space of neutral feelings and living in that and having
right. Exactly. Exactly. And I liked what Aya said this morning. Whatever's happening, just investigate that. Don't want it, I want it this way, but whatever's happening. If it's boredom, good. What is boredom like? If your body is aching, okay, what is that like? Exactly where it is. If you have some time with between breaths and there's no thought, that was freeing. So there's everything to investigate, everything. And this practice absolutely does work. The last thing I want to say about this is, along with those two suggestions on working with the delusions or perversions, I would also say be willing to say, I'm sorry. Be willing to admit you're wrong and not try to make excuses for it. A really heartfelt apology. And I'm saying this from the bottom of my heart because I'm having a situation right now with one of my oldest friends, and I don't know what happened to us. Something, there was a misunderstanding. I saw things one way. She apparently saw things another way. And we didn't yell, we just quit speaking for 2 years. And I was telling Aya right before I left for Michigan, I wrote a long letter just saying, I think I have really misunderstood what took place. I don't think I'm seeing your point of view at all. And I apologize for not doing that. And can we fix this? And I got a text message just 2 days when I got back from Michigan, and she said, there's gaps to fill in. I'm so happy. Let's get together. It took me 2 years to admit I possibly did something wrong. I didn't know what it was, but I probably did. I want to know what it is. And I trust this person to tell me what it was. And I will tell her how I feel. I think that's a good way of not being attached to this ego, and it's got to be my way, to be willing to say, I'm sorry. I apologize. I don't like the way this happened. I'm at fault. So that's it for my talk.